You'll have a minute and a half. If you could describe very quickly the hand-sized pet, it can be anything you want that will fit in your hand, and then briefly introduce yourself.
Okay. Hand-sized... Hand-sized pet, I would choose a bird so I can fly. I think that would be fantastic. A little bit about me. My name is John Kanoky. My last name is K-N-O-K-E-Y. I grew up in a manufacturing family, so my great-grandfather, grandfather, and dad all worked in wood products manufacturing. And then graduated from Montana State, where I played football. And I think that's important because it taught me how to lead in an environment of diversity. After graduating from Montana State, I went to go work for a small startup software company here in Bozeman. We had no employees, really, when we started. I was the five. We all got hired at the same time. Within 2 years, we had about 2,000 customers, and we were competing against Google and Microsoft. I went from a cold call sales representative to a vice president, and from a very young age, I've been immersed in P&L and business growth. Then I went back east to Dartmouth and Harvard and got degrees in business and government. And that's where the need and desire to get back into Bozeman really hit me. Because I was on the East Coast with a very young family and enormous amounts of school debt. And trying to get back into Bozeman is really, really hard. And for me, it's about what do we do for economic growth in Bozeman, and that's why I'm running. What do we do about the cost of living here in Bozeman? And then what do we do about our smart infrastructure so that we can keep Bozeman the last best place? That's a little bit about me. I've been married for 11 years. I have three kids, a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 3-week-old.
Thank you. Let us know when you're ready, timers. Cool. Go ahead, Mr. Pope.
Thank you. First, let me thank you. Thanks to the League and for Ford Montana for bringing us together this afternoon. My name is Chris Pope. I'm representative of House District 65. I've been in that position for 2 years, and what my district is probably the fastest growing district in the state of Montana, I'm guessing. My wife Maddie and I moved here 25 years ago, started a business, my wife and son Ben, and my father-in-law Jerry are in the audience today. I appreciate their being here. Both Ben and Jesse graduated from high school here in town. I've been very active helping Bozeman grow, working downtown, working with Eagle Mount, Montana Conservation voters to build Bozeman into the wonderful place it is. But the work's never finished, and our successes have grown into challenges as we watch our 5% growth, annual growth, clog our roads and create a myriad of challenges that I think we as a community are going to have to start paying attention to with the state government's help. Good government matters. Working together, we can all make a difference. My template for going forward is to be smart and forward-thinking on those things that we can control, that are critical to our quality of life, promoting small business and job development, and being fiscally prudent. Thank you.
You two ready? Mr. Brown.
Hi, my name is Zach Brown. I represent House District 63 in the legislature, so campus, University District, Southwest Bozeman. My favorite animal is a magpie, so I got to pick that one. I ran for the legislature for multiple reasons, but first and foremost, I'm a Bozeman-bred, Bozeman-raised guy. I used to, when I was a little kid at Hawthorne School, I used to buy toys from Mr. Pope here at his downtown small business, and John was my football coach in high school. So I have deep roots in this community and could think of no better place to live than in Bozeman, Montana. I'm a public education advocate from Hawthorne to Bozeman High to the Montana University system. The legislature has a huge part to play in maintaining and enhancing our public education system in this state. It's the great equalizer, and it's the central part of maintaining a competitive economy for the state of Montana. I'm also a hunter and a fisherman. I actually got out of hunting camp about an hour and a half ago, which is why I'm sweating trying to get back here. And our stream access laws, our public trust doctrine, which dictates our wildlife and fisheries management, and our basic culture that values hunting and fishing, and outdoor access is so central to what makes our economy competitive and what makes this one of the best places in the world to live. And I'm a huge advocate for those issues in the legislature and will continue to be. Lastly, I guess that was last. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. King.
My name is Jim King, and I'm also running in House District 63. I come from an Air Force family. First of all, pint-sized pet, I'm going to go with a chipmunk because they're very industrious, and they have a tendency to taunt my dogs on a regular basis. So, I'm running because I see a lot of federal overreach in the state of Montana, and I think we need to put Montana sovereignty at a much greater priority than our past legislators have done, legislatures have done. Namely, the CSKT Water Compact, I think is which I'll get into later. I think that's a horrible law for Montana, and as we've seen, as it's gone to Washington D.C., it's turned into something entirely different from what our legislators had intended. So. I really believe that the federal overreach is an issue. When you look at what happened to Joe Robertson, who is a 77-year-old veteran in Montana, Missoula, it's absolutely unjustified. That he was prosecuted for after having gotten the permits from the Army Corps of Engineers to build stock ponds on his property. This is what we need to protect Montana citizens from, is this kind of overreach, particularly when the federal government was in fact and indeed stopped from pursuing prosecution against our citizens.
Thank you. Ready to go? Cool. Mr. Hamilton.
Hi, I'm Jim Hamilton. I'm Democratic candidate for House District 61. Gerbil would be going along with me just because they're cute. You know, I had a lot of people talk to me before I started running about what was necessary for a legislator in Montana. And the things that came out is you need to listen well. You need to respect other people's opinions. You need to be able to sift through a lot of information and come up with the relevant points and find common ground and build bridges and get something done. And that ties into the career I've had for 33 years. I'm a financial advisor, spent a lot of time talking to clients individually about tax issues, finance issues, insurance issues, and building their trust so that we can reach their common goal. I can almost not think of a job that would have been better to help prepare me for the legislature than that. You know, when I look at the second thing that I thought prepared me was my volunteer service. I've been involved in a lot of volunteer activities and, once again, bringing disparate groups together to get things accomplished in Bozeman. Groups like the Rotary Club, and Fix-Up Festival, Gallatin Valley Land Trust, and so forth. When I boil it all down to what I think we can get done, it's to be a just and compassionate society that develops good public education, which leads to good jobs and a healthy environment.
Mr. Wendt.
Hi, my name is Francis Wendt, and I'm the Libertarian candidate for House District 61. I want to thank the sponsors and everyone here for attending. It's really important to get people engaged in the voting process and in our democratic process. Basically, libertarianism is based on three principles, social equality, individual rights, and fiscal responsibility. Those are things that I feel very strongly about, and what I think the main issues that we have addressing us are the increased cost of healthcare and the reduced access that we're seeing lately. The main thing that pushed me into the race was the medical marijuana laws. It was very distressing to see what the choices that the legislature made to do that. And increased access to mental health care is also very big point on me. As far as me, I'm a fifth generation Montanan. My mother was born in Bozeman. I moved here in 2006, and I'm an 11-year military veteran. I currently work at UPS as an operations manager, and my education is in business and economics from Montana State University. As far as my community involvement, I'm an actor, and I am also a member of the board of the Blue Slipper in Livingston.
We're all set. Go ahead, Mr. Ganser.
Oh, good afternoon. Neil Ganser here. Gene and I, who's sitting back there, came to Montana for me to attend the School of Architecture at MSU in 1974. We quickly got into business, in addition to being in school, in a filling station on Main Street, and we have been in business in this valley ever since. That includes contracting and also distribution of insulation products and development and sale and national distribution of a product we called Corbond insulation. So we've had it every way from Main Street to national business, and it's been quite interesting. We competed with the big boys in that arena and actually defeated them in most every encounter that we were in. So part of what goes on in the legislature is a lot of negotiation, and business is full of negotiation. You work every day to make things work for everybody, and that includes not just your suppliers and yourself, but also your employees and the staff that's closest to you, as well as those that are not so close. It all has to work together. So you have a mini society that you're in charge of, and it's been a delight and I think useful experience for the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you all for your responses. We will move to our first question, and each of you will have a minute and a half to respond, and it is regarding infrastructure. So we'll start with Mr. Kanoki and move down. So our first question is, what are your infrastructure priorities, and how do you think they should be paid for?
So getting into the campaign and going out, the best thing for me has been knocking on doors. I've knocked on over 2,000 doors and talked to a lot of people about what is the number one thing that concerns us in District 65. And by far and away, the number one thing is the cost of living here in Bozeman. Number two is wage growth, and number three is infrastructure. When you have a situation where we are last in wages, and we were just talking about this, two of the three precincts are a lot of young families starting up. Husband and wife work, and there's usually a third job somehow in the house where a husband or wife is moonlighting. The last thing I want to see done is just increasing taxes for the sake of increasing taxes. We have a $2.5 billion annual budget, roughly, in the state of Montana, and this area is the most used in the state when it comes to tourism as well. I think we need to work through the appropriations to make sure that we, one, pass an infrastructure bill, and B, use that infrastructure bill to fund the congested areas that we have in Bozeman. So, for me, The idea of a sales tax would only fly as if we really reduced our property tax to make that happen. Otherwise, we're going to be taxing citizens where the number one concern is the cost of living and trying to make a living.
Thank you, Mr. Kanoki. And when our timers are ready, Mr. Pope, you will have the floor.
Thank you. Just because I missed it, flying squirrel. And that's because flying squirrels are joyful. And that's kind of an important thing to be. So infrastructure is one of the most painful subjects that we went through in the 2015 legislative session. Given the amount of deferred maintenance on our state assets, it's in the billions of dollars. We missed by one vote the Senate Bill 416, which would have basically put $150 million in the tank to do the important work of the state government. And that we folded on. It was a partisan vote. I support the governor's Build Montana Trust to put $200 million into state infrastructure spending. As it regards Bozeman, I would say the city is being very fiscally responsible, but here we go. We have a largely self-financed water and sewer system. We've got an impact fee, which has been very hard for the city government to levy, but they have responsibly. But here we are with major projects that are unfinanceable the way we have it right now in terms of our government structure. So we can't do it alone. To pass the my priorities would be the funding of Romney Hall, which is a $28 million project, which put a ton of jobs and money into this community. And second, CAGI. CAGI is a $15 million project that badly needs some support with state funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. And Mr. Brown, when you're ready.
All right. Infrastructure, this is going to be a tight session financially. Tax revenue income is lower than what we projected. I was on the tax committee, which is in charge of the state revenue estimate. So keeping the status quo alive is going to be a struggle, and any new spending is also going to be a struggle. But in all discussions about new spending, infrastructure has to be the number one priority because we have let the people of Montana down over the last half decade on this issue. The fact is, talking about cost of living, I completely agree it's an issue in this community. When the state underinvests in infrastructure and education, local communities have to backfill that support by asking property taxpayers to foot the bill. And that's part of the reason we have such a high cost of living in Bozeman, and the state has more obligations that need to be met. We need better roads, schools, bridges, deferred maintenance in our school system, in our university system, in state agencies. Huge problems. We have large, inefficient buildings that cost a lot to maintain. I just want to say that I think, from my vantage point, we can all point fingers and there's two sides to every story, but we failed at infrastructure last session because there was a small group of folks that were willing to put the people of Montana in second place to their own ideology. Over how we paid for infrastructure. We have to think about compromise, statesmanship, and putting ideology aside to create a stable foundation for the economy of Montana, and that starts with investing in infrastructure.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And Mr. King.
Well, you know, Jim Hamilton mentioned a few minutes ago having been a part of Rotary, and those of you familiar with Rotary International, they have a four-part test. And when it comes to infrastructure, I want to implement a three-part test that's not too dissimilar. Number one, does it predominantly benefit all of the public? And this is where I think what the great disagreement was in this last legislative session, was because Romney, Jim, as well, in addition to that, was also the governor wanted a museum in Helena. Both of those were pork barrel pet projects to bring money back to certain districts, to specific districts, not infrastructure spending that was spent statewide that benefits all Montanans. Even here in Bozeman. Now, I've been in Romney Gym a number of times. I happen to be a person who dances Argentine tango, and we've had a number of functions in there. However, that constitutes a very small percentage of the public who will be utilizing and benefiting from that facility. This is why things like that are not appropriate. Is there a positive economic impact? Certainly, a $28 million project, there's a positive impact on our local community, but what about the rest of the state? As legislators, we have to be thinking in terms of infrastructure spending statewide, not for specific districts in Bozeman and Helena or elsewhere. And lastly, is there a positive environmental impact? So, Denise Heyman, she has a bill coming up. I'll bring that up later. But she has a bill coming up regarding hazardous materials. And we have to have the ability to clean those up in case there's an issue. So, and that probably will fall under something to do with infrastructure as well.
Thank you, Mr. King. And Mr. Hamilton, you have the floor.
I would agree with something that Chris said here a couple minutes ago, then that watching the last legislative session from the vantage point of the Chronicle editorial board, we followed that closely, and it clearly got stopped on ideological terms as opposed to the practical benefits. But if you look at Montana's grades for infrastructure by the American Society of Civil Engineers, our schools, D-, wastewater, D+, dam, C minus, drinking water, C minus, irrigation canal, C, transportation, C, transit, C plus, solid waste, B minus. We've got a lot of problems in Montana. We need an infrastructure bill. There'll be a lot of negotiation, I think, about the order and the priority, and we can argue about that all day long, but we need a bill. So the strong positions that I'll take if elected to the legislature are, number one, get a bill passed. Whatever it takes, let's get a bill passed and get to work on these problems. Secondly, we need the jobs. They're good-paying jobs that work on infrastructure, and that's a benefit to everyone. Third, this bill should be bonded to the maximum extent possible. I'm in the financial world, and you have the lowest interest rates in history. You don't avoid bonding for the bill. Romney Hall, I disagree with Jim, is not a pork project. You know, MSU is an economic engine for Bozeman. Bozeman's an economic engine for the state. You take very good care of the goose that lays the golden egg.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Wendt.
So my perspective on infrastructure is that that's one of the quintessential necessities of government, is to provide the requirements to live and work and enjoy the wonderful places we have here in Montana. And I agree with Mr. Hamilton on the scorecard that that's horrendous. I disagree in the fact that this problem stems from the fact that we're not looking at this with foresight. We're not looking at it with the building maintenance. We're not looking at it with the lifespan of these infrastructure in place. What we truly need to do to repair our infrastructure is start saying that if we're going to build a road for X amount of dollars, then we need to say in the future we are putting aside money to repair, to replace as necessary, because we can create those financial instruments and we can put that money aside so that we're not just spending and raiding the bank and asking for mill levies every time we need to change and put more infrastructure in place. Growth is an important thing, but we need to start looking at and effectively valuing our impact fees so that as Bozeman grows, we do have the ability to grow along with it.
Thank you, Mr. Wendt. And one second. Mr. Ganser.
Infrastructure is definitely the purview of government, and we do have mechanisms in place that it would appear we have to enhance in order to catch up on some of the projects that have been mentioned. Clean water is, of course, the beginning of a decent living standard anywhere. And then the wastewater that flows from that, of course, is the second. So those things should be the absolute number one priorities in infrastructure. So this will happen, I'm pretty confident, in the next legislature. And I would like to be a part of that. I know quite a bit about construction, having been in it for 50 years. And I would also like to find out just how bad the bridges are. In other words, I'd like to lay eyes on some of these projects myself and with the engineers and have them describe to me, because we don't have bridges falling down around the state of Montana. Let's verify what they're telling us so that it's not just tear down a bridge and build another one, but truly a replacement need. That's just an example. You could use bridges or any of the other items that are brought up. Thank you.
Thank you all for your responses. We'll now move to submitted questions from the online website.
Yeah, so one of the things that we did was we did a story of self-training where we had people work on specific questions that would help them tell their story. And then we also did a crowdsourcing thing online where people would submit questions that they had throughout the county. So that's how all of these questions were taken. So this one's in regards to tourist tax. Big Sky, West Yellowstone, and other tourist communities have been allowed to craft their own local option tax. What are your thoughts on allowing all Montana communities to be able to craft their own local option tax as opposed to going to the Montana legislature? Go ahead, Mr. Genzer.
The local option sales tax or resort tax is not a bad idea. It's fraught with, you've heard the term slippery slope. We do this, then we make it higher, then we do the county. They want in on the deal, and then pretty soon it's a statewide sales tax, which I'm not sure anybody is really in favor of. Somebody probably is, particularly governments. So if indeed it happens, it must be considerably less than they're asking for, because there is no possible way to give government all that it would like and expect anybody to be able to afford to live anywhere where government is taking that much. It should also have a 50% reduction against the property tax in any community where it's put into place. They don't want to do that. They want to do 25%. Eventually, I suspect it would be zero. My negotiating position was, if you want 25%, I want 75% back to property tax. This cost of living, as John mentioned, is constantly brought up when you're knocking on people's doors. And it's not just the city, it's also in the county. So it has a possibility with care. It may be structured. If it's not done carefully, it shouldn't happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Wendt.
So this goes back to the infrastructure question, and the cost of living is tied directly to the property taxes. And it doesn't affect just the property owners. It also affects the rental markets. And if we are doing anything along the lines of tax relief on the property side, we're not necessarily hitting those rental markets. I am in favor of giving the option to the local community to implement a sales tax if they need it. But they also need to go through and place that before the voters. And that's where our democracy really shines, is that we have the ability to scrutinize and say, what is actually necessary? Prove it to me before you just tax and spend away. Because Mr. Ganser is absolutely right. If they're going to implement a sales tax, it's a very regressive tax. It goes against some of the lowest income families here in Bozeman. Bozeman itself has 20% in poverty, and that's a very scary thought when you start asking them to pay more for the things that they consume on a regular basis. So I want to see what Bozeman has to offer, but I also want to be very skeptical of it. It's not acceptable to tax the poor to try and pay for the companies that are coming in here.
Thank you. Ready? All right. Mr. Hamilton, you're up.
As I'm out knocking on doors, three things come to the fore very quickly on the doorsteps. One is protect access to public lands. Second one is property taxes in Montana are too high. And the third one, which has surprised the daylights out of me, is we want a sales tax. It's what I'm hearing on the doorsteps. I did not expect that at all. When I talk to people about it, what I say usually, you know, I think statewide sales tax is not going to pass in our lifetime. But we have the possibility of the local option sales tax. And as I talk to them about it, there are several things that I think stick out in my mind. Number one, local control. We get to vote in the tax. We get to sunset it when we want. We can choose to vote short of that. We can choose what's in the tax. We can choose how much goes against property tax. This is just an ideal situation. We have millions of tourists coming through Bozeman at this point that are chuckling at us because we have no sales tax, we have low gas tax, we have low bed tax. And I think we need to ask them to help us participate in helping us keep up the facilities they're using in Montana or in Bozeman. Last thing I would say, the slippery slope idea I reject completely. Whitefish has had a resort tax for 20 years and has never changed the amount that goes to property tax. It can be done, and it can be done with local control. Look on the internet at Whitefish's tax. I think you'll see interesting information about what's being excluded. It's not going to hit us very much.
Thank you. Mr. King?
So I have two college degrees. One is in music, the other is in economics. And when we start talking about taxation, this is why economics is termed, is dubbed the dismal science. Because it's always a balancing game. So when we look at taxation, particularly sales tax, it inadvertently is, as Frank has mentioned, is regressive. You know, we have to keep in mind what is the ultimate impact, what is the ultimate gain, and where's the aggregate benefit to our community. So I've had some conversations already with Chris Kokolsky, who incidentally was one of the engineers of the Whitefish local sales tax. So what they're trying to do is to make sure that there are resources that are consumed by people who don't live here, who don't pay property tax. And so what they're trying to do is defray some of the cost of those resources. So now, as others have mentioned before me, because it's local and because the voters get to decide on their own local taxation regarding this, I don't have any problem with it because I think it's perfectly fair, because it is in a democratic style and is democratically decided as to what an individual community does in terms of performing and advancing their taxation. So I have no personal problem with it, but ultimately, again, it comes down to that balancing act and what is the aggregate benefit. So that's where I'm interested in seeing what the city of Bozeman puts together, and hopefully it would be beneficial to the city.
Thanks so much. Go ahead, Mr. Brown.
All right. To the local option sales tax, it sounds like most of us are so far pretty much on the same page. My requirements for any local option sales tax bill is that, first of all, it's directly tied to property tax relief. That has to be part of it. I believe there should be a sunset on it, so that voters have to renew the tax rather than having it be on the books in perpetuity. They need to be voter-initiated by local municipalities, local communities, and those are my requirements. I would just say that I'm not supportive of a statewide sales tax. One of the reasons why Montana has some of the higher property tax rates in the country is because we don't have a sales tax. So it's one of those situations where we can't eat our cake and have it too. I'm a renter, and so I indirectly pay property taxes through my rent. But I do think that a couple things we forget from the tax committee's perspective are that some of the reasons we rely particularly on residential property taxes for our revenue streams at state government are that there are a lot of exemptions and lower rates calculated for agricultural lands, and there are many loopholes for commercial lands in terms of how they're assessed property taxes. And so when the legislature makes those kinds of decisions, it puts the burden on someone. Somebody has to pay for the bills, and that's where we're at. But if it's the right bill, I will support a local option sales tax. The community of Bozeman gets it because we receive so much pressure from tourism.
Thank you. Mr. Pope, go ahead.
Thank you. Like the others, I'm in support of this. I actually had a bill draft for this last session. I sat in local government, the committee that oversees the interface between the state and the local governments, and it's surprising how much antagonism there is to local governments being able to make decisions about their future and how to put together a healthy long-term funding plan for the community's best interests. And so we can't take it for granted that this particular initiative would pass even if we all got behind it. It's the number one priority of the city of Bozeman from a fiscal point of view. I've spoken to the city public works director, and he can't pencil the next 20 years based on our current revenue streams. It is a regressive tax. We need to make sure that there's a certain amount of relief, 35% of that revenue stream, and I think we all saw in the paper that it's a $30 million number, to be able to circle back and help those who are putting in. But you can also be very careful about exactly what you're taxing and make sure that this has the least impact on those who have trouble paying and basically pays for all of the visitors that we have coming through town. So thank you.
Thank you. Last one, Mr. Kanoki.
Yeah,
Thank you. I am not in favor of a local option tax. I think the discussion on a local tax has everything to do with our failure to pass a infrastructure bill in the last legislative session for $150 million. Right? We have taxation, and we have the ability to figure out how to pay for our infrastructure, and we just didn't do it. And when you talk about, you know, property tax relief, that's great until you actually dive into the numbers and you say, well, you pretty much have to relieve almost all the vast majority of the property tax to not tax the citizens more, right? When you talk about a 3% sales tax. So you're almost flipping it around, and I think what you end up doing is putting the onus on younger families that are renting, college students to pick up the tax bill. We have mechanisms in place. We have funding in place. We just need to do our job in the legislative session and pass the infrastructure bill. You know, one more thing here. Part of being a good legislator, I believe, is being a detective and an investigator. And right now, there's an audit that is in the public domain that has been given to the city that has said that we've misappropriated $7.2 million of these impact fees. Right? That's going to be news here pretty soon. Hopefully, I was hoping the Chronicle would be here. But if you can follow the money and follow how we tax something and then how we should spend it versus how we actually do spend it, we are just not, from a good government standpoint, doing our job. We didn't pass a legislative bill, and we're not allocating the impact fees properly.
Thank you all for your responses. We're going to switch the order again. So for this next question, Mr. Kanoki will start, and we'll move downward. And our next question is regarding women's rights, and it was submitted by Alice Buckley. So what are your greatest priorities with respect to women's health and rights? How will you bring these concerns into the legislative sessions? So, Mr. Kanoki, when you're ready.
Yeah. So when I think of women's health, I look at it through the eyes of what I want for my daughter, Avery, and my daughter, Quinn, when they get older. I tend to be more pro-life because I think we need to change the conversation between pro-life and pro-choice to what it actually means to go through that process, and how do we figure out to minimize that on society and in general on the long-lasting effects of that decision. As far as healthcare, reproductive healthcare, I'm all in. We gave our first daughter the middle name Eleanor for Eleanor Roosevelt. We gave our second daughter the middle name Rosa for Rosa Parks. And I'm going to do everything in my power, legislatively, as a dad, you name it, to make sure that whatever it is that they want to do on this planet, they will be able to do.
Thank you, Mr. Kanoki. And when you are ready, Mr.
The question about health care or about all women's rights generally?
It is about both women's health and rights.
Okay. I am four square for a range of women's rights, including health care. I support keeping the government out of the woman's right to make decisions about her body. I feel that, there's no conditions on that. It's a completely simple path that we all should take. I also believe in promoting equal pay for equal work in our economy. And I think it's sort of a disaster that here we are in 2016 and the women's wage is 73 cents on the dollar. It needs to change. We need to address those things head on. But I will protect, I have a daughter as well who, I just feel like these are very basic considerations, and we'll do everything to protect a woman's right to make her own choices on her health. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. And Mr. Brown, whenever you are ready.
Okay. First of all, I definitely support equal pay for equal work. Also say that I hope that at the end of my career, when I'm retiring, maternity leave and paternity leave are just a basic thing that Americans take for granted. I think the fact that we don't support working families when they have children is something that puts the conversation about equal rights between genders totally out of balance. When it comes to the pro-choice, pro-life issue, of course, it's a tough one, and it's such a polarizing one, which I found out my first month on the doors when I first ran 2 years ago. At the end of the day, in my own life, I'm pro-life. If I create a life, I'm going to take responsibility for it and raise that child, give everything to it. When it's not my life, I'm not dictating that choice on anyone else, certainly not a woman. So I'll make my own decisions in my life and allow others to do that as well. And then the last thing I'll say is, this is something that didn't make any headlines in the newspaper, but I am so proud I was part of last session, and everyone on this stage who was in the last legislative session, we made Title IX funding a statutory appropriation, which means that that funding is guaranteed in perpetuity, and we never have to have an ideological argument about it again. That Title IX funding will support basic reproductive health and women's health services in perpetuity, and that's one of those things that snuck through under the radar that is going to leave a lasting legacy in the state of Montana.
Thank you, Mr. Brown and Mr. King.
Well, I can say that I have never been one who's protested at a Planned Parenthood rally or anything like that, or before the state capitol. But I have led three friends over the course of my lifetime to not have an abortion, and all three of those women were very thankful that I did, because they were given the opportunity that they didn't necessarily see to give such an incredible gift to somebody else who could not have children. So I am pro-life again at the end of the day. In fact, I'm pro-life at the start of the day. That's very important to me. However, the Supreme Court has made it very clear that a woman has a right to obtain an abortion. And legally, I have no ability to stop her. I can try and convince her in a compassionate way. But that is the extent, I think, of my ability, because ultimately the right is hers from a legal perspective. So in college, we also live in a college town. So in college, I had a good friend of mine who was raped. And I actually found out about it directly, and instead of dropping her off at home, I brought her to the hospital, and it's about, I don't know, 3:30, 4 in the morning. And we go up to the counter. I said, "This is my friend so-and-so," and she believes that two people had sex with her without her consent. I think we need to teach people the importance of integrity in our relationships, and that's what's ultimately going to protect women from something so hideous. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King and Mr. Hamilton.
As I think about this issue, the first thing that strikes me is the total unfairness in a just and compassionate society of women being paid 75% of what men are paid for the same job. That should not exist. I also think that we could do a lot more in our society to equalize family leave and parental leave. So when I think of rights, I think of one of the rotary tests: is it fair to everyone concerned? And so it's an easy answer on the equal pay issue. It's a lot more difficult answer, both for some personal reasons as well as philosophical reasons, on the issue of reproductive health and reproductive rights. I would have to say, though, that I come down firmly on the side of pro-choice. And number one, because I think that women get the right to make that decision. And number two, in a just and compassionate society, we never abridge the rights that have been given to any of our citizens by law, and that's the law of the land. I will work very hard in the next legislature to make sure what I call the backdoor attempts to abridge that law are not successful.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. And Mr. Wendt.
So this really hits down to the social equality and the making sure that every individual who lives in this country, lives in this state, lives in this city, all has equal access, equal opportunity, and they are not discriminated against over gender, religion, race, any of those things. Gender is one of those main things. I think it extends to gender identity as well. It's just comes down to the fact that we do live in a culture where we have different perspectives on how women should act, how women should be treated. And when one of our presidential candidates is making derogatory statements that leads directly to rape culture. It's the system that's broken. We have the laws in place. We need to enforce them. We need to be holding people accountable that are making this society untenable to live in. As far as abortion and women's health rights, yes, we need to make sure that those are coming. I am definitely pro-choice. There, it falls to the individual to make those choices that best suit them. Any time that the government's going to be dictating to a person how they need to live their life, you're going to get an improper result. As I said, we live in a society that propagates rape culture, and I know several women personally that have specifically decided not to report.
Thank you, Mr. Wendt. And finally, Mr. Ganser.
Indeed, the right to choose is the law of the land. I am an adamantly pro-choice candidate. Excuse me, pro-life candidate. I've never made that slip before. And what I did was spend the last 15 years working with a pregnancy care center to give young women full disclosure about the choice that they had to make. And I believe in individual action, and I believe that this was a way that they could make the kind of choice they so deserve to be able to make, completely and well-informed. And I would push for that on a legal basis because, indeed, it protects women. Secondly, as far as equal pay is a thing that's come up in the city of Bozeman here lately, I would like, if you could, to ask my daughters what it's like growing up in a household where it's equal protection under the law and equal rights. They learned that if they could do what everyone else was doing, they could earn what everyone else was earning. And I also did that in my business. I've had approximately 300 employees over the years. Some of you may know some of them. You'd sure be welcome to ask them.
Thanks, everyone. The next question is on the environment, and it's from an online question by Nicole Buettner. If elected to the state legislature, what would you do to help support Montana communities that rely on coal and oil if the economics and market don't support the cost of mining or drilling? We can start with you, Mr. Ganser.
Boy, this is an old Montana problem, isn't it? If you've ever explored the mountains and found the ghost towns, you know that this is an old Montana problem. So there was action taken to provide a support network to get people to move, to be retrained, and not have their communities completely decimated. I would really like to see a little more sensitivity in the environmental world from the environmental movement about this. And maybe they can step up and start supporting the results of their actions against Montana families and industries. Thank you.
Mr. Wendt?
So, as Mr. King said, everything in economics is a balancing act. It comes down to, do we support coal, do we support oil, or do we support the environment? Because there are trade-offs. I think that there is a possibility to do both, and it really comes down to not showing favoritism in the marketplace. Things like the Clean Power Plan actually show immense favoritism to renewable energy resources. If you look at the plan as it's put out by the EPA, it will effectively shut down all coal-producing, all coal-fired power plants in Montana. And so is the EPA going to be providing relief to those? Because that's a federal mandate. That's one of the things that we really need to step up at the state level and start pushing back on these federal regulations that they're mandating to us. My proposal is that we stop trying to infringe on this and put the taxes on the production of coal and oil and use those to be earmarked to reinvest in our environment. That gives us the option to mitigate climate change based upon a renewable, continuous use without negatively affecting the communities that rely on these resources.
Thanks. Go ahead, Mr. Hamilton.
I think it's best when we think about our environment in Montana to think of our what would be best in the long term for a healthy environment in Montana. And clearly the best thing for a healthy environment in Montana would be to focus more of our energy on renewable energy. So that would be a leaning certainly to go that direction. The other thing I think we need to pay attention to is the market is telling us, and once again, being a financial guy, I pay attention to the markets. The market is telling us very clearly that coal is on in basically a death spiral. And for us to resuscitate it at this point does not make much sense. However, it does concern me a great deal about the people who may lose jobs because of something they didn't cause. Given that, I think we need to devote some effort to, as I've been saying on the doorsteps, spending more money, investing more in community colleges to help those folks find new jobs and get retrained to do something other than what they have been doing. Secondly, I think there's great infrastructure possibilities at Colstrip, and I'm not an expert at this by any means, but great infrastructure possibilities at Colstrip to turn that into something that we could use for wind energy. And I think we need to look as carefully at that as we can.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. King.
You know, in Montana, we've had considerable challenge, particularly around coal. And Colstrip United was started by in large part by Ashley Dennehy of who's a Colstrip resident. Her husband is actually works in the plant there, having been a miner and a plant manager. When we look at coal, unfortunately, coal has gotten a bad rap, in my opinion, and it's largely led by the special interests. And when they go out, if climate change is real, if global warming is real, the last thing we want to do is close down manufacturing and power production facilities in the United States that are far cleaner, far more competitive than anywhere else. Because when we close those, the market you have what's called a market response. And someone else, somewhere else, usually in a place like China, Malaysia, Indonesia, India, countries where the guidelines and the rules are not nearly as strict or are not enforced, that produce a great deal more greenhouse gas emissions, a great deal more particulate matter that's released into the global ecosystem. I even point out on my website that the special interest, while they're patting themselves on the back and raising their champagne flutes for closing yet another manufacturing or power production plant, that's gone somewhere else to produce 100 times the damaging environmental issues that would have been presented here.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Brown.
Thank you. I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with my opponent on that last point. The facilities that are being shut down, if you take Colstrip 1 and 2, for example, are not clean or competitive with other facilities in this country or other countries. Even the most ardent coal supporters in the legislature, Dwayne Ankeny, who is a coal miner himself, a Republican in the state Senate, has become convinced of the reality that the fact that those facilities are just at the end of their natural life. So whether we repurpose those facilities, rebuild them, or build something else, they're at the end of their time, and that's just a reality that we have to deal with. That said, as coal is in a death spiral as an industry, one thing that the climate community really owes and environmental interest groups and everyone up here and everyone in our state and community, we owe the people of Colstrip our sincere gratitude and compassion, because that facility and other facilities like it in the coal industry have provided us with cheap, affordable power that has helped build the Montana's economy over the last 50, 60 years. And that's something that we risk deepening the polarization in the state if we overlook that and don't look people in the eye and say, thank you. We owe you gratitude. Moving forward, the biggest connection, briefly in 15 seconds, that we need to make is the connection between the restoration economy and the industrial economy that exists. Too often those jobs who are could be employ the same people with hard manufacturing skills who run forklifts, there's a lag time of 10, 20 years in between those two industries, and if we could connect those dots, we could keep those people employed.
I got this one here. Thanks very much. Go ahead, Mr. Pope.
I sit on the energy committees in the state legislature, and just about a month ago voted on reparations for coal strip families. We have a disaster sort of happening right in front of us out on the eastern part of Montana due to no fault of their own. However, you start looking at the corporate structures that are happening. They're all out of state companies that have been operating in coal strip. They're responding to market forces. They're in bankruptcy. The state of Washington, the state of Oregon, basically terminated their market contracts for purchasing coal power made in Montana. And that has shut those facilities down, units one and two. I have a proposal that's going to be going to the legislature through the Energy and Telecom Committee, just passed about 3 or 4 weeks ago, that would create a governor's task force to identify replacement investment opportunities for wind and solar, geothermal, and energy storage. We have an energy storage company right here, Absorca Energy. We have a wind energy company, Orion. They can put 300 or 400 megawatts of firm wind power into Colstrip using the Colstrip transmission system, and this would be a home run for Montana. It's a 100-year plan. We can do it. We should not get hung up on whether coal should be around or not. It's simply going away. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Go ahead, Mr. Kanucki.
Yeah, so the premise to my response is we are given one wild and precious planet, and we've got to take care of it, and we've got to conserve it. But this hits home for me on a personal level because when I was a senior at Montana State, my dad called me and essentially said that he had to lay off 30 union workers and there would be no job because I came from a lumber manufacturing family. So I can understand and appreciate what that means and what's going on in the coal strip community. One thing that really strikes me about the word conservation is it was created by Theodore Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot. Gifford Pinchot started the United States Forest Service. And the genesis of the word was to use natural resources wisely, to use them wisely. So this issue to me is not a far left or a far right issue. And I don't think we just go out and we ban coal. I think what we try to do is we try to bring coal into the 21st century and be innovative. We sit on a sea of coal. How can we make it cleaner and better? How can we take our natural resources to the next level? And inspire a state to do it, which could use our resources and create good jobs. Another thing we have with the logging, we have people on the legally shutting down logging, and now we're seeing all of the added costs because of our forest fires. We have got to get back to, I think, what the genesis of what conservation was, and that is to use wisely and not to politicize it.
Thank you all for your responses. Our last question before we move on to closing statements will be regarding prison reform. So we will start with Mr. Ganser, I believe, and then move down. So in what ways would you upgrade prison reform?
Could you be a little more vague?
Yes, could you qualify that a little bit?
This could be open. We changed it up a little bit on you. Just overpopulation of prisons, you can talk about ways that people are being incarcerated, minimum sentencing, three-strike law, just kind of your interpretation of ways that we could improve on prison reform.
I'm not sure, but I may be the only one up here that's actually spent time in the Montana State Prison. Thankfully, they let me out, the same day. And so I was visiting several times in a ministry capacity, and one of the things that we're just learning to take advantage of is successful ministries. Some are Christian, some are not, that are actually reducing recidivism, which of course reduces overpopulation. And to let these successful organizations or processes work within the prison system, I think, is absolutely essential. And there has to be a board that can assess the success of those arrangements and what is working. And there's a lot of, would you might say, discrimination or prejudice about one type of thing working and another type not working or working, but it doesn't have the same philosophical basis as another. And we sort of have to get over that and say this is working, and let us help the corrections actually correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ganser and Mr. Wendt.
So, overpopulation of prisons, there's a lot of empirical evidence that points that directly to the war on drugs. Some things like medical marijuana have we just created 10,000 criminals in Montana. And that's a fact. That's how many people were holding medical marijuana cards, and now they are being arrested. They're being transported to Billings. They're being transported elsewhere. These are people that we had sheltered for the past 12 years, and now they are criminals. That is what the legislature has done. The more we qualify and the more we say that these types of laws need to go forward, the more that we take an ideological stance and say that we can criminalize more, that we're just feeding that population. Let's look at the root causes of what is causing these crimes, what is causing them, and try and solve those problems from the very foundation of our society, rather than just putting a Band-Aid on it, throwing someone in prison, and then all of a sudden we have a prison population issue. And it doesn't stop there. It goes to the Law and Justice Center being on the ballot this election cycle. Let's figure it out. Let's stop incarcerating people that aren't victimizing people.
Thank you, Mr. Wendt and Mr. Hamilton.
This is an issue that interests me a lot, and it interests me a lot because it sort of, in my mind, juxtaposes with education. If I think about the populations that are often in our prison, we have issues, mental health issues that are being addressed, or maybe I should say not being addressed in prison, that could be addressed elsewhere. We have less violent criminals that could be in a community program that would save us all a tremendous amount of money, I think. And the third one is that we're trying to rehabilitate those with drug problems in a place that is never intended to do that. We need to have more of a community-based drug rehabilitation program so that those folks are not repeating their visits back to prison. When I think about this, I think about it both from an economic point of view. There's money for us all to be saved there, and I think that money, if there is in fact money available from that, would be better spent in the education process than it would be in the correction process. One of the reasons that I really focus on getting greater investment in early childhood education.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton and Mr. King.
We're hoarding microphones up here. So, we mentioned recidivism. I think one of the reasons that there's a high recidivism rate, we've also mentioned mental health, and that's a big issue. And one of the causes of mental health issues with former inmates is largely the fact that they are isolated in a community. They feel all alone, much like veterans with PTSD. I'm a veteran myself of the United States Marine Corps. I've met a lot of folks who have these mental health issues. I've met a lot of folks who spent some time in prison, whether for for multiple DUIs, whether it was for other, you know, some aggravated misdemeanor or some aggravated offense. So we have to resolve the isolation that they feel once they are released, and you know, that's going to come. I think a lot in our education system as well. So, on release of inmates, challenging them, having some sort of accountability structure to challenge them to be more involved in a community. So, you know, whether that's a program that looks something like Alcoholics Anonymous, or some other form of a process like that. And a lot of folks are going to jump quickly on the right versus left, Republican versus Democrat, etc. And that's not it. And in fact, I'm sure that my opponent, he and I have actually talked about this, and I agree with him. And I'm going to let him introduce it to you. I don't want to steal his thunder. But he talks about, you know, he's planning on introducing a bill that expunges and introduces an expungement process for nonviolent offenders. And I support that bill.
Mr. King, thank you, and Mr. Brown.
And thank you. You totally stole my thunder because I was gonna tell everybody how classy of a guy you were, and that you just showed everyone. So there you go. I was gonna lead off. Everybody in the audience is saying, "Be specific." So this tees up an opportunity to explain a specific bill that I'm working on right now. It would introduce an expungement process in the state of Montana. Many other states have an expungement process. So if you make a mistake when you're 18 or 19, but you grow up, you learn your lesson, and you start contributing to the economy, but your criminal record's holding you back, there's a process that you can go through, and you can get nonviolent offenses taken off your record so you can fully participate in society and in our economy. So that's something I'm working with Republicans on, and I appreciate the endorsement of my classy opponent. Nonviolent drug offenses. It is insane to me as a 26-year-old, so I have a different perspective as a millennial, but it is insane to me that we legally prescribe essentially synthetic heroin in the form of opiate painkillers, but we've criminalized marijuana. It's nuts, and it's clogged up our criminal justice system and turned people that were pretty much functional into criminals and put them on a downward spiral where they're not contributing to the economy and costing us millions upon millions of dollars. Finally, Montana has to increase the capacity of our court system. Our district courts are chronically overburdened, and that's a big issue that's being studied during this interim. And there's many people in prison just waiting to get a court date because district judges have so few slots available. So we need more district courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And Mr. Pope.
Thank you. I think it all begins with the word compassion. We in society tend to split people off, and I think we've done a darn good job of it in the past 30 years, locking folks up, three strikes, and what we find is we've got a system that's outrageously expensive. It does not rehabilitate. It does not fix anything. And honestly, it's an embarrassment. We in this community want to think that we're supportive of those who are in pain or who are in struggle or who, frankly, just didn't have the starting point growing up to understand how to line their priorities up. I'm speaking very generally, and it's not going to help next session, but I do think that, unfortunately, Representative Brown had some good specific ways to address this, but honestly, it's an issue around poverty and education, and we need to get our heads wrapped around what it is that's driving young folks into substance abuse, broken families, poverty. It's a very big subject, and yet we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, putting our fingers in the dike. So I think it's prime time to circle back and start thinking about exactly how we've constructed this badly and how we can fix that part. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pope and Mr. Kanoki.
From my perspective, I don't think we need to do much in the way of reform for violent criminals or repeat offenders. I do agree that nonviolent drug issues need to be reformed, so I'm supportive of what you guys were discussing there. One of the things that really gnaws at me and why I'm running is one in six Montanans are in poverty. And I'm working right now with Ron Eli out of Hamilton, who sits on the Health Human Services Appropriations Committee, on what we can do for community-based mental health issues. When we talk about things like Alzheimer's or post-traumatic stress or some mental issues that we know are correlated to drug abuse, which then we know are correlated to prison incarceration, what can we do to get out in front of it? It's a tsunami that's that permeates all of our lives in Montana, the high suicide rates, the high drug use. And I think the best thing we can do for our prison system is to try to get out in front of it and alleviate people going to prison. And one of the best things I want to be a big, strong proponent of is mental health community-based funding it and making sure that we get people who need that the right treatment. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all for your responses to that question and all the questions in particular. Now we're going to move to the two-minute closing statements. So we will begin with Mr. Kanoki and move to Mr. Ganser.
I've talked a little bit about tonight of why I'm running. 3 weeks ago on Monday, I got to hold my son in the hospital. And, you know, that's a neat experience, right? Holding your kid and saying, nothing's going to happen to you. The world is your oyster. Go do what you want. And on September 19th, that day, Bozeman Hospital had the most babies ever born in one day, which was going to get broken twice this month. So we are in a tsunami of people here, and we know that. We know that people are coming. We know that we're last in the nation in millennial wages. Depends on which governor, you ask the governor or the guy who's running for governor, we're somewhere between 42 and 49th in wages. We know we have the challenges ahead of us. And the reason I'm running, and I like Chris, and to me and him, it's not political. We have different views, but you guys are here tonight because you are vested and interested in what we're doing in our community. And the more that we do not polarize and go right and left and not listen to each other, the better off we're going to be. And so my focus in this next legislative session is going to be on focusing on lowering the cost of living, making sure that we do not raise our taxes 20.6% like we did last term, and then focusing in on business investment. Good, high-paying wage jobs here in Montana. And I said it before, and I'll say it again, I'm going to fight like my children's future depends on it. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kanoki and Mr. Pope.
Well, thank you for a lively discussion. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with my colleagues. I have had an interesting 2 years. It's been a very challenging 2 years, but it's also been an incredibly rewarding 2 years fighting on behalf of the Bozeman citizenry for things that will keep our town the way we think it should be, a quality of life that includes, you know, a vibrant economy, quality public schools, clean environment. And these are things that I've worked on hard. I'm a cancer survivor, and I carry around with me a sense that we need to be thankful for the extraordinary gifts that we have received to be in this town. I believe that we all have a responsibility, each and every one of us, to do what we can to each and every one of us to protect that quality of life, to be compassionate, to listen to each other, to work for principled compromise, and to honor our remarkable public institutions, which are imperfect, but make no mistake, they are the foundation of the peace and decorum and stability and economic vitality that we all treasure. Good government matters. I look forward to continuing my efforts to make a difference. I am honored to have served my constituents in House District 65, and I ask them for their support this coming November 8th. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. And Mr. Brown.
All right, thank you. I too am finishing up my first session, and it's a fascinating job. none of us here are doing anything other than because we care about taking care of our community. We have different ideas about how to do that. But everybody up here is just trying to move Montana forward in our own way. Certainly aren't doing it for the money. That my brother teases me all the time. It's $10 an hour in the legislature, and McDonald's is hiring for $12 an hour. So that's his favorite thing to remind me of. I want to thank Jim, and he didn't steal my thunder on the expungement thing. He stole my thunder because I wanted to thank him for running such an above-board race focused on the issues, and someone that I feel like I can call and talk to, and you've just been a really classy guy, and it means a lot to me to be able to run a race where we can talk about issues and leave all the personal junk elsewhere. And that's how I like to operate as well. Something I didn't mention in my opening, I'm the second youngest legislator in Montana. When I first ran, I was 23. I'm now 26. And representation matters. My generation is going to inherit the state. I'm going to raise my kids here someday. My nieces and nephews are going to grow up here. And having young people at the table, having the millennial perspective at the table means something. It means I'm part of shaping the Montana that my generation is going to inherit. And so that's a huge motivator for me. I also want to say that my foundation in this community is my folks are small business owners. And the number one thing I learned watching them own a retail business for my entire life and more is how to treat people. You don't stay in business unless you know how to treat people with respect and take care of your community. And that's an ethic that I've taken to Helena. I treat people as human beings, and I listen, and I genuinely try and make friendships and show people that I care about their perspective and that I want to work with them to find a common ground and move Montana forward. And that's why I'm running for re-election, and I hope I can earn my constituents' support again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown and Mr. King.
Well, I too would like to thank my opponent. I can't think of one of the things I really appreciate about Zach is he's the kind of opponent who absolutely challenges you to run a better campaign. Any of you who know Zach, and I'm sure many of you do, it's hard to think of somebody who could be a better friend. Regardless of, again, the Democrat versus Republican thing. That, if we can demonstrate this anywhere in the world, and especially anywhere in our own country, it's here in Montana that regardless of distance, we are all still neighbors. No matter what, we are all still neighbors. And whether your neighbor is a Republican or Democrat and they say, hey, we slid off the road and we're in the ditch, can you help? Come help us, help pull us out. Absolutely, because that's what we do as neighbors, and so we engage in conversation. That's one of the things that I really appreciate about my opponent. I mentioned earlier federal overreach, and I'm actually the victim of a federal overreach. Dodd-Frank prevented me from obtaining a home loan inside House District 63 because I was unable. It used to be I'm, by the way, a recovered mortgage banker. By the way. Years ago, you could actually use 75% of anticipated rental income your application for a home loan. You can no longer do that. Nowadays, under Dodd-Frank, that house has to have a two-year rental history. Well, how do you have a two-year rental history on a property where the foundation was just laid 4 months ago? You can't. So, and now in Bozeman, we have a situation where we have a very tight inventory, a reduced inventory, and we have a booming population. So, I think one of the things that I want to see in terms of negating some of this federal overreach is giving people the ability, somehow relaxing federal rules through state law so that people may still purchase a home, especially when in a market like Bozeman, it makes good economic sense for them to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. And Mr. Hamilton.
Once again, I'd like to say thank you to League of Women Voters, Forward Montana, Business and Professional Women, and there's, I think, three or four more organizations that have sponsored this, so thank you for doing that. I eagerly look forward to the possibility of being elected because what I really want to do is find ways to help Montana. And I think that I have the right experience for that. I think I have a very good ability to consider both sides and in looking at both sides, build some bipartisan bridges, which I think we desperately need to do. Many of the issues that we've talked today are important ones, but there are going to be hundreds of more bills that are going to be considered in the legislature. And so what I'd like to close with is sort of my statement of values, because I think that statement of values tells you from what direction I'll be voting when I come up to those issues that we haven't talked about today. So bear with me here a sec. I call it, and as I've mentioned it several times, what does a just and compassionate society do? Well, in my mind, it lends a hand, or at least it offers the tools to those who are less fortunate than us, but it does so respectfully. It creates a level and fair playing field in all parts of society so opportunities can be accessed by a number of folks. It avoids discriminating. All people are welcome in a just and compassionate society. And it improves conditions for not only this generation, but the millennials and the next generation and the next generation. And it protects and lifts up the vulnerable. It does not abridge the choices we have been given as a result of being humans, nor those protected for us by law. And it acts toward each member of society with civility and integrity. And most importantly, it gets stuff done.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Wendt.
So, I ran for this office prematurely. I had plans to go into politics quite a bit later in my career. I haven't finished my degrees from MSU. I'm about 14 credits shy. I'm currently still working. I don't have anywhere near the capital that I should have to mount a campaign. But what I have seen is that I've seen gridlock in Helena. I've seen a two-party system that basically stunts our way of life. I'm a libertarian because I believe in personal freedom. I believe in the ability to get things done. And when we're talking about the two sides, the right versus the left, that's not how we live in Montana. We are independent. We don't care about the one person. We care about what is best for us, what is best for our independent spirit. And this state was settled 8 generations ago. 8 generations. That's it. And we're devolving into this concept that we tried to get away from in the East. We just need to stop trying to put the government fingers into our lives and say, you know what, we can figure it out. We can do it the best. The reason I'm here is I'm here to offer a fresh perspective to these two-party politics. It gridlocks it. It hurts us. It puts people in prison. And it takes people's jobs. It puts us one of the lowest in the nation economically. And it costs lives.
Thank you, Mr. Wendt and Mr. Ganser.
I'd like to return for a moment to what's really a drug problem, not just in this community, but it affects our communities across the state, and it affects our prisons and so on, has been well discussed. I'd like to see a change in our high school education system that allows sophomores in high school with their whoever counsel they take from parents or others to take a trade path or a college path. I think that's something that we're doing, and believe me, I've hired a lot of tradesmen in my life, hundreds. We're sort of retarding some people, young people, from doing with their hands what they would be much better off doing than to be caught in the pre-college, high school situation. And this is done in some European countries, specifically Germany, and you know what the things they make look like, quite nice. So I think that we really need to come up with a way to allow that to happen. I've studied a little bit, and I'm sure there's other inputs for that. Secondly, regarding the cost of living, particularly Bozeman, but in the county and all around, is there may be an opportunity to consider a primary residence property tax value freeze as they do in several other states, and there's much more to be said about that, but it would help reduce people getting taxed out of their homes, particularly the elderly. Thank you.
Thank you for your response, Mr. Gaetzer, and all of you.